Welcome to the Emergency Medicine Cases Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Anton Hellman, bringing you Canada's brightest minds in emergency medicine from EMC Studios in Toronto. EM Cases is part of SREMI, Schwartz-Reisman Emergency Medicine Institute, the nonprofit organization dedicated to improving EM care through research and education. The opinions expressed on this podcast are intended for information and education purposes only and should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any medical condition, nor should they be used as a substitute for medical advice from a qualified practicing physician. In part one of this two-part podcast series on asthma with Dr. Lior Sommer and Samir Mal, we covered asthma mimics, risk stratification, ED treatment, and who's safe to go home. We drove home the points that there are many important details in risk stratifying these patients. We need to make sure that they're on the right medications and have good discharge instructions to avoid bounce backs and morbidity. And although that wasn't the most exciting topic for emergency doctors who don't have attention spans that are very long, I'm pleased to say that this current podcast will be a lot more exciting because we're going to be talking about the crashing asthmatic. Welcome back, Dr. Mal and Dr. Sommer.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you again.
All right, let's jump into a case. You get the heads up from dispatch that a 38-year-old woman with a history of asthma has felt more short of breath over the last few hours despite taking her inhalers, and that her husband called for an ambulance because she told him in broken sentences that she felt like she was going to die. She comes rolling into your resuscitation room with the following vital signs: heart rate of 130, respiratory rate of 40, oxygen saturation of 88%, and a blood pressure of 150 on 100. She's tripoding, clearly using respiratory muscles, and looks kind of drowsy. So, Dr. Mal, let's start just with a general overview of your approach to the crashing asthmatic or the about to crash asthmatic.
Yeah, this is definitely one of the most challenging cases that I think we as emergency physicians, transport physicians, intensive care doctors will encounter. These patients just require so much intensive bedside resuscitation. And some of it goes contrary to the usual ABCs that have been constantly taught about. So it's a bit counterintuitive at times. There's a few things right up front that make me extraordinarily concerned about the individual you just described. So first of all, in broken sentences, saying she's feeling like she's going to die. She's been taking her inhalers at home, and now she comes into the emergency department with a respiratory rate greater than 40, which immediately in asthma is a red flag to me. And I'm sure we'll get deep into the depths of gas trapping and auto peeps soon. Her oxygen saturation of 88%, meaning she's not moving much air, as this is traditionally not a disease of oxygenation. And she's in front of you looking horrible outside of her vital signs. She's tripoding, really working to breathe, and starting to look drowsy as well. So whether she's fatiguing, her CO2 is going up, it could be any combination of things. We always talk about calling for help, and this is definitely an individual where if you have the benefit of getting an extra set of hands with another emergency physician, your local friendly intensive care doc, Dr. Tillman, if you want to come down and help out, that would be great. And then in your institution, if you're lucky enough to have respiratory therapists to help with medication administration, and of course, your best emergency department nurses, as this patient's going to need IV access and multiple IV medications pretty soon. So up front, I talked about BCAAs in part one of the podcast. So my focus really on this patient is first, primarily their breathing and their circulation. And then airway is my very last consideration, that I am only going to go down that pathway if my hand is absolutely forced. So up front, we're going to give all the therapies we've spoken about to this patient. We'll end up on oxygen via nasal prongs right away and immediately begin bronchodilator therapy, likely with nebulized treatments of both a beta-2 agonist and an anticholinergic agent. Get as many peripheral IVs as you can, hopefully some antecubital, planning ahead to potential IV beta agonist therapy so that we can potentially run those peripherally. And then remembering that these patients are likely all volume deplete as well, even though she is quite hypertensive right now. She'll have quite a large load of insensible losses through her skin and respiratory tract. Again, planning for potential intubation and worst case scenarios, making sure that we're replacing her IV fluid volume. In addition to nebulized treatments of beta-2 agonists and anticholinergic agents, these are patients who I'm also going to be running magnesium, and I'm also going to be considering either an intramuscular dose or, in my preference, a peripheral infusion of epinephrine as well as an acute bronchodilator to really help try to get this patient out of their acute exacerbation.
All right, fantastic. So
you're going to be throwing all the bronchodilators at them. I'm assuming steroids as well.
Steroids, I didn't mention. Yep, of course, that's not going to work for about 4 to 6 hours, but an absolutely crucial piece of treatment would be also giving an appropriate dose of dexamethasone or methylprednisolone.
Yeah, and not forgetting that these patients are essentially volume depleted. And so a fluid bolus is always a good idea, especially if you're going to be giving them the magnesium, which can decrease the blood pressure. So you're preventing the hypotension from the magnesium that you might give. Epinephrine, whether you give it IM or IV, sometimes I guess it depends on how many IVs you have. If you only have one IV, you might want to dedicate that to your magnesium and steroids and give the epinephrine IM. And then we'll talk a little bit later about ketamine and non-invasive, and then we'll get to the airway. I want to go back, though, and talk about medications in particular that we didn't really get into detail in part one on. And the first one is magnesium. We talked about IV magnesium in pediatric asthma in Quick Hits 50 with Dr. Susan Hsu. And we came to the conclusion that while the evidence wasn't great in kids, it's still worth giving in severe asthma and to give it early. That was pretty much what we came up there. We're talking more in adults now. Dr. Sommer, what's the evidence behind IV magnesium sulfate being beneficial for severe asthma and life-threatening asthma in adults? And then the question which comes up frequently is, what dose should we be giving?
Not a lot has changed in the treatment of asthma over the past 20 years. Unfortunately, I'm going to say the same thing about magnesium. There's contradictory evidence, there's evidence that it helps, and there's evidence that it doesn't make a huge difference. And so the evidence that it doesn't make a difference is that it doesn't have a huge difference in the patient's lung functions with severe asthma, but there is evidence that it will decrease the amount of hospitalization in severe asthma. So patients who potentially you turn around could actually be dischargeable. And I think that's a bit of a diametric shift for many of us, because most of us do not give magnesium in patients who we'd even consider discharge. Usually those are the patients who are almost slam dunk admissions for most of us. But potentially, if these patients do turn around, they're less likely to be admitted to hospital. So whether that's you discharging them or someone you refer them to discharging them later, that makes it less likely. So the evidence isn't robust and great.
Yeah, I just want to pick up on that point there that in the old days, if you gave magnesium, that would be an indication to then admit the patient because that would signify that they're really bad. But I think we need to change our thinking that we should probably have a lower threshold to give magnesium and not get stuck in the mindset that if they receive magnesium, they then need to be admitted to hospital. Because then, even though we know that the evidence suggests it decreases hospital admissions, it would actually increase hospital admissions if you're in the mindset that giving magnesium is sort of a red flag for patients that should be admitted sort of thing.
Right. So your admission and discharge criteria shouldn't change based on the magnesium alone. And if the patient is improved and you've reassessed them and they continue to improve and they've been in the emergency department for a reasonable amount of observation, irrespective of the fact that they've gotten magnesium, they could be dischargeable. In fact, potentially because of the fact that they got magnesium, they could be dischargeable, though I don't know that the evidence is robust enough to tell me that yet. I think there's little downside to giving magnesium other than the potential hypotension that it can give, but that's easily managed in the emergency department.
Okay, yeah, we talked about giving fluid and that there's insensible loss. So there's two reasons to give fluid, insensible loss, and also if you're giving mag, then to prevent the hypotension with mag. And then that leads nicely into the dosage that we want to be giving for mag. So there's doses that I've heard all over the place, you know, start with 4 grams, start with 2 grams, repeat it twice, repeat it 3 times. What's an easy, simple way of remembering and giving mag for these patients?
So normally the starting dose is going to be 2 grams for most patients, but that's not where you stop. So you can give 2 grams and then you can give another 2 grams 10 minutes later and another 2 grams 10 minutes later. So I think a minimum of 4, but really the target of somewhere around 6, as long as the patient's blood pressure can tolerate that.
That's also been my practice as well. Just by default at our institution in the emergency department, our nursing colleagues are directed to give the magnesium over 1 hour, I think, to potentially mitigate those effects of hypotension. But, you know, this is not the patient that we just described presenting to us is not the one who you're going to be gently titrating some of our therapy here as they're having a life-threatening exacerbation. So as long as you have good IV access and you're planning for and prepared for potential hypotension by giving fluids and having someone already mixing vasopressors for you, I'm giving magnesium magnesium, 2 grams over 10 to 15 minutes with 2 more repeats. So a total of 3 doses, 6 grams over the first hour.
Fantastic. So not a ton of data in life-threatening asthma, but for severe asthma, we do know that there's a 25% decrease in hospitalization when you give MAG. That's not bad. As long as you give it not too fast, you keep an eye on their blood pressure, you give a fluid bolus, it's probably worth giving to all your severe asthma patients. And a reasonable dose would be to start with 2 grams over about 10 minutes and repeat that twice for a total of 6 grams. And then some experts do recommend an infusion after that of 4 grams an hour. But hopefully by that time, the patient will be up in your ICU.
Absolutely.
One other advantage of giving magnesium in these more severe asthma episodes is that you're going to be giving some very cardioactive agents, particularly epinephrine, which is, to me, a game changer in the treatment of asthma. I've seen patients really turn around with that. But the magnesium could act to blunt the potential cardiac effects of the epinephrine, particularly blunting any tachydysrhythmias that you might get from giving a reasonable amount of epinephrine in these patients.
Great. Nice little bonus there for giving MAG with epi. And that segues very nicely into talking a little bit more about epinephrine. We did talk about epinephrine in detail in our crashing anaphylaxis episode with Dr. McKenzie, but I think it's worth going over here. We've already mentioned that IM epinephrine is acceptable, especially if you don't have more than 1 or 2 IVs going. If you're going to use IV epinephrine, I'm assuming we're talking about the crash dose epinephrine. You take a crash cart epi, inject it into a bag of saline, swish it around, take out 9 cc's, and then you can give a cc at a time. Any tips or tricks or considerations when it comes to epinephrine in the severe crashing asthmatic?
Like Dr. Summer said, I think epinephrine has really been a game changer for these patients. The severe asthmatics are going to have a hard time getting the inhaled beta agonist into their really small airways. So by giving them IV epinephrine, you're going to get it into the circulation and it'll get to where it needs to be. I'm personally a big fan of using intravenous epinephrine when able. I like the fact that intravenous epinephrine is so titratable so that I can just turn it up and down and it's short acting versus if I just take a syringe of 1 mg/mL epinephrine and inject it in some big leg muscle somewhere. I'm not really sure when it's exactly going to hit peak circulation and how long that's going to last. And if a patient has an adverse reaction, I'm kind of chasing my tail. So I think when possible, if your department's able to, definitely start an IV epinephrine infusion. I love your idea there, Anton, about having a push dose epinephrine syringe available as well. Take 1,000 mics of epinephrine, the 1 mg, and put it into a liter of normal saline. You can have a mic per mil and just draw that out into a 10 mil syringe. And then you can give 2 to 5 mils at a time, 2 to 5 mics at a time to titrate to effect. I just like the intravenous route for these patients much better.
I just wanted to add one more thing. You know, it's great when we know that the patient is coming and we can expect them to be sick, that we can perhaps ready some push dose epinephrine because it's great to have that at the bedside. But doing it in the moment in front of a sick patient can be difficult and could be prone to error. So if you have an adult that you need a push dose amount of epi, the dose will be roughly 1 microgram per kilo. So if you want to use crash cart epinephrine, 0.5 to 1 cc of crash cart epinephrine will give you between 50 and 100 micrograms, which will be 1 adult dose of push dose epinephrine. And again, if the patient is crashing and extremely sick, the last thing I want to be doing is mixing up a push dose. I will take the crash cart and give 0.5 to 1 mL of that cardiac epinephrine.
Great pearl. Let's move on to perhaps the most talked about medication in all of emergency medicine, and that is ketamine. So ketamine, as most of us know, is a bronchodilator, and it can be an anxiolytic if you get the right dose. And we've all seen it do great things in terms of maintaining respirations, even when we give huge doses of ketamine. And anxiety seems to contribute a lot to these patients who are going downhill. Some experts believe that settling the anxiety will improve the respiratory status, and ketamine seems to fit well with that. Some docs recommend using dissociative dose ketamine in the patient who's about to arrest to break that spiral of hyperventilation very quickly. But subdissociative dose ketamine in patients who don't need to be intubated is a little bit more controversial. Dr. Mal, First, what's the evidence for ketamine use in severe and life-threatening asthma? And when would you recommend giving it besides when you're intubating the patient?
I'm glad you brought up ketamine. I think it's every emergency physician's favorite drug at this point. But after seeing some of the ill that it can do personally, I definitely am very cautious with it. It's a drug where, especially in these asthmatic patients, we're talking about the severe life-threatening asthma here. It's something that I'm not going to be doing in isolation. Once the patient is at the stage where I'm potentially considering giving ketamine, so they've already had all the other treatment we've discussed. But I'm also already in my head planning for next steps. So I'm hopeful that this ketamine will turn this patient around, but already in the background, while my nursing colleagues are getting this drawn up for me, I'm going to be prepping my intubation equipment. I'm going to be prepping my ventilator to administer non-invasive ventilation to this patient. I'm going to just be ready for any complications that may arise. With respect specifically to ketamine in the asthmatic, so again, it should only really be done in the extremely sick patients who look like they're at the very least going to be requiring non-invasive ventilation. So tripodding in front of you, potentially altered, extremely high respiratory rate. The thought with the ketamine is that it's probably breaking this cycle of anxiety and your agitation-induced tachypnea in addition to some of its own bronchodilatory effects. And then ultimately, it helps me put this patient and make them cooperative enough to be put onto BiPAP. So I'd like it for those reasons that for the most part, it will maintain the patient's respiratory rate. That being said, I have absolutely been involved with cases where patients are completely catecholamine deplete and immediately do drop the respiratory rate quite precipitously with ketamine. So although it is quite safe in these instances, like I said, you want to be already prepared for next steps when you're administering a drug like this. Also, just another complication to note, it probably will cause, depending on the doses you use, potentially some emesis and bronchorrhea, which can be deleterious in these patients. With respect to the evidence for it, it isn't great. The best data that we do have was from a single center RCT, I believe it was in 2018, on just under 100 adults. And they use much lower doses, I think, than maybe some emergency physicians are used to. They compared 0.3, 0.4, and 0.5 milligrams per kilogram as a bolus, and then followed that up with the same dose as an infusion over 30 minutes. They used peak expiratory flows as their marker in this paper, and they found that the patients who got 0.4 or 0.5 milligrams per kilogram bolus followed by the same dose as an infusion over 30 minutes actually did much better. That's really the only evidence that we have in ketamine. Other than that, we're talking about kind of small prospective studies or non-randomized papers, so just not really high quality. And especially now once we start getting into the realm of the severe life-threatening asthma, it's tough to do randomized research on these patients. So the quality of evidence for some of the medications and treatments we're going to be talking about in this section probably isn't the greatest. It is kind of based on educated expert opinion. But I think with ketamine, it provides a number of benefits over other agents, given that patients will likely maintain the respiratory rate. It'll help you get this patient on NIV, but always prepare yourself for worst case scenario.
Fantastic. So just to summarize there, think about ketamine when you're reaching for your non-invasive. Be careful in the catecholamine depleted patient. And if you're going to use it, the dose in the RCT that seemed to work was 0.4 to 0.5 milligrams per kilogram bolus, followed by a 0.4 to 0.5 milligram per kilogram infusion over 1 hour. So that would be 25, 35, 50 milligrams. If you need just a number, 25 to 50 milligrams is probably a reasonable amount to start with. Dr. Sommer, your opinion on ketamine for the near crashing or crashing asthma exacerbation?
I couldn't agree more that these are the sickest asthma patients already. So in any sick patient, you have to be really careful with dosing of ketamine because a little can go a long way sometimes in these patients, especially if they're already deplete. So I know that the studies say 0.4 to 0.5 milligrams per kilo, but you could potentially even go lower and titrate up. It is titratable. The onset of action is about 90 to 120 seconds, so you can always give a second dose if things are not going well, whereas you can never take it back once you've given it.
Fair enough, yeah. I think we've all had patients that are catecholamine deplete where we give this tiny little homeopathic dose of ketamine and are very surprised to suddenly see their blood pressure tank or their respiratory rate tank. So start low, go slow, but the evidence would suggest that about 25 to 50 milligrams is a reasonable dose, and then another 25 to 50 milligrams over an hour. All right. Ketamine, as we mentioned, is a great anxiolytic, and that can at least theoretically help in these patients. When it comes to anxiolytics, what I remember seeing kind of in the old days, thankfully I don't see it too much anymore, is the use of benzodiazepines as an anxiolytic in patients with asthma. Dr. Sommer, what's your take on using benzodiazepines as an anxiolytic for these patients who are in the throes of an asthma exacerbation that we feel we need to lyse their anxiety?
In short, don't do it. There's evidence to suggest that there's increased mortality in these patients. Benzos are amazing drugs. We've all seen patients come in hyperventilating in the throes of a panic attack, and we give them a little dose of sublingual lorazepam or your benzo of choice, and they get better almost instantaneously. The patients who come in with asthma exacerbations are usually anxious because they can't breathe. And so you got to treat the can't breathe part of this first. Absolutely, there's a catecholamine surge and there's a level of anxiety here. But if you ignore the fact that this is a respiratory illness, these patients are going to do poorly. Benzos in particular seem to have a bad effect on them. And there are other agents that seem to not have that association, in particular ketamine and potentially opiates. So I would avoid benzos in these situations.
All right, enough said about benzos. And that segues nicely into opioids and their role in the crashing asthmatic. Dr. Mel, what's your opinion on using opioids? Generally speaking, I understand it's for anxiolysis as well. What's the role of opioids in the management of these really sick asthma patients?
Opioids are an interesting point to make. We're all so cognizant while we're going through our residency training about the specific ventilator settings that we need to be mindful of with patients who have obstructive lung disease and making sure their IDE times are okay, make sure the respiratory rate is low. But I don't think that that same philosophy has necessarily translated over to the awake patient who's in front of you. And I think that's where a medication like fentanyl can be really beneficial. We kind of alluded to earlier that an acute asthma exacerbation really revolves around, you know, patients that they have their asthma trigger, they get dyspneic, they get more tachypneic and more anxious, and that leads to more gas trapping. It gets harder to breathe, and then they get more dyspneic, and it's this vicious cycle. And really the problem is these patients, the faster their respiratory rate gets, they have less and less time to expire, and they accumulate more and more air in their lungs. That leads to diaphragmatic fatigue and exhaustion. And where I think fentanyl has a role in this situation is that you can immediately drop someone's respiratory rate. It's a very quick acting drug, doses of kind of 1 to 2 mics per kilo up front. So, you know, if we give someone somewhere between 75 and 150 mics kind of on average, it's a fast acting drug that's easily titratable. And you can try to break that cycle that I touched on, where you can allow these patients to have more time to expire, to decrease the amount of air trapping and auto-peep that they're developing. And then also, this isn't a drug that's going to work in isolation, allow all the other medications to actually take effect and deal with the underlying pathophysiology of asthma. It's a drug I've used a few times in this situation. Most of these patients have also ended up on NIV, and traditionally I have been giving some ketamine as well once the patient's in that level. But I think acutely, if it's a drug that you have available in your emergency department, I would recommend, if the patient we're discussing here whose respirator is 30, 40, 50, just unable to speak even words in front of you, decreasing this patient's respiratory rate acutely while it takes time to set up your BiPAP circuit and to get some of these other medications, it can definitely be of some benefit.
Before we move on to airway, I want to touch a little bit more on medications, and in particular, beta agonists, or short-acting beta agonists, SABAs, salbutamol that we use here in Canada, and talk about the IV route, because I can't remember the last time I've seen IV salbutamol used. But I understand that especially in these severe crashing asthma patients, it might be difficult to coordinate the nebulizer with your non-invasive. It might be easier just to do IV salbutamol, and I understand that the evidence is pretty good for it. And we also mentioned in part one that most of your nebulized beta agonist is going into the air and not into the patient's lungs anyways. And so it might make sense actually to use IV salbutamol. So Dr. Mel, what do you think the role for IV salbutamol is? And if you could remind our listeners of what the dose is so that it's easy to set up if we do need to go to IV salbutamol.
Absolutely. So for the reasons that you just mentioned, this patient who's extremis is going to be unable to be cooperative with using a metered dose inhaler, giving nebulization. Most of the drug is going to get delivered to the walls of your resuscitation room anyway. So IV salbutamol in this instance, it can be of great benefit. It's something I actually hadn't used in Canada at all during my residency training. But then when I did ICU transports in Australia, it was a drug that patients with obstructive lung disease were frequently transported on. So it was something that I got comfortable with abroad. Thankfully, my hospital here in Canada does stock IV salbutamol. So it's something that I do use. And after my dose of either a push dose epi or if I'm really stuck an IM dose of epinephrine, I do like to use salbutamol over epinephrine as an IV infusion, just because I am kind of really isolating the beta 2 effects of the salbutamol. The typical dose range is you would start anywhere from 2 to 5 mics per minute, and you can titrate up every 20 to 30 minutes to a max of 20 mics per minute is typically the dose range that we see. The same side effects that we would be concerned about with epinephrine and other sympathomimetic drugs we need to be cognizant of here. So making sure that you're monitoring the patient for a significant tachycardias and hypertension is important. But it's a drug that I've had good success with that I do like to use in severe life-threatening asthma.
All right. I mean, for me, that's sort of a game changer. And I'm not even sure whether we stock it in the emergency department that I work at. I'm definitely going to go and ask my admin people if we do stock it. And if we do, that's good to know. IV salbutamol, 2 to 5 micrograms per minute over about 15 minutes initially. And then you want to titrate up from there. A word from our sponsor, Metricade, the experts on scheduling systems. Since 2015, I've been using Metricade, the incredible self-scheduling system that has made my life and the lives of my colleagues so much easier. Metricade can really help minimize the drawbacks of shift work we all know so well by not only ensuring equitable distribution of shifts, but also integrating circadian rhythm-friendly recovery time into their algorithms. They minimize my sleep deprivation, which allows me to be a better EM doc on shift. I can take better care of my patients and still have energy left after my shifts to enjoy other aspects of my life. Check out metricade.com/emcases for more details on how this awesome scheduling system works. So far, we've talked about a general approach to the crashing asthmatic. We've talked about MAG. We've talked about IV salbutamol. We've talked about ketamine. We've talked about anxiolysis and opioids. I think it's time we dove into airway management, which can be very challenging in the crashing asthmatic. Before we dive into airway management, Dr. Mel, you've touched on the pathophysiology of asthma in these really sick patients a little bit, but I think it's a good time to really drive home what we need to understand about the pathophysiology of the crashing asthmatic before we talk about airway. So Dr. Mel, in 1 minute or less, we don't want to get too bogged down. What are the key things to understand about the pathophysiology of the crashing asthmatic?
So these patients cannot tolerate an elevated respiratory rate as that decreases their length of time for exhalation. This is an obstructive airway pattern. So the less time the patients have for exhalation, the more air they're retaining in their thoracic cavity. The worse that gets, the harder time it is for patients to breathe. They get more anxious. They get more tachypneic. It decreases the time that these patients are going to take to fatigue out because of how tachypneic they're getting. You have all the hemodynamic effects of increased intrathoracic pressure starting to take hold. You have diaphragm fatigue as well, as now your diaphragm is trying to fight against this increased intrathoracic pressure. So the pathophysiology is intubation will not be fixing it. It's just a supportive measure while everything else still works. So don't forget to continue to treat the disease in the background.
All right. So you've got this poor ventilation, your muscles are tiring, you're getting hypercapnia, you're getting acidemia, you're getting hypoxemia, you're getting encephalopathic, and they can't exhale, essentially. Anything you can do to decrease their respiratory rate and give them more time to exhale, the better. That's a nice setup for then how we're going to manage their airway. Before we get on to the indications for airway management in these patients, I want to talk about PCO2 because there's been many times in the past where someone on the team comes up to me and says, oh, their PCO2 is 80. You better intubate them now. What is the role of that number, that PCO2, in your decision to intubate or not intubate a crashing asthmatic? Dr. Sommer?
It's similar to the peak expiratory flow in patients who are far less sick. It's a data point. It's an important data point, but it's a data point that has to be used in the clinical context of that patient's trajectory. So when was that taken? What was the treatment before? What's the treatment been after? And how's the patient doing now? So yeah, the CO2 could be 80. And then they've gotten a whole bunch of beta agonists and muscarinic agents and steroids and everything else, and they've improved. And so that number in isolation is not that important. I do think that if you've already taken a blood gas, and in this case, we're really talking about venous blood gas. I don't think there's any role for arterial blood gases in these awake patients. So venous blood gas, then you can do another one as a serial assessment. And certainly if their CO2 level is rising over time, that's a bad indicator. And that would make me consider whether this patient is going to need some assistance in their ventilation, probably non-invasive first. But it's, again, only a data point and it can't be used in isolation.
Totally agree. We're going to be talking about when to intubate these patients soon, but of course, our first go-to before we intubate is probably going to be non-invasive positive pressure ventilation like BPAP or CPAP. There's also high-flow nasal cannula. Dr. Mel, what's the role for high-flow nasal cannula, BPAP, and CPAP in the management of these crashing or near-crashing asthma patients?
Great question. These are ultimately patients who present with moderate and definitely severe exacerbation should be started on non-invasive ventilation, and it should be done kind of early in their course of illness, right? We really want to prevent the situation where they're getting clinically worse in front of you, their tachypnea is getting worse, their air trapping is getting worse, and then potentially you're going to reach a situation where they're profoundly acidotic, hypercapnic, and you're facing someone who's in the respiratory muscle fatigue. So your threshold to use some sort of non-invasive ventilation should be fairly low. Potential indications, I usually use kind of a respiratory rate that's in the high 20s, low 30s, or someone more importantly who's having a significant work of breathing in front of me to begin NIV. With respect to using BiPAP versus CPAP, it kind of depends on your school of thought. I've honestly heard just incredible arguments in both directions for this, but we're probably slightly referring to a couple of specific patient scenarios within the life-threatening asthma patient. So if you take, you know, one school of thought, the patient who comes in who's profoundly tachypnic in front of you, his respirator is in the 40s and 50s. This patient's issue is going to be the fact that they're auto-peeping. And with that increased intrathoracic pressure, they're just not going to be able to trigger that NIV and take a breath in against that increased intrathoracic pressure. So in kind of an instance like this, I think there's a great argument to be made that CPAP is probably all that you need. It'll just make it easier for that patient to take that breath in. It'll probably stent your airways open a little bit too. If we go a little bit later on in the course of the same individual's illness and now they're starting to fatigue a little bit, their respirator is dropping, and not because they're clinically getting better, but in fact, they're getting worse. Now, I think there probably is a role for adding some inspiratory pressure in this case so that you can decrease someone's work of breathing and make sure they're getting kind of adequate tidal volumes. So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution. I think ultimately, whether you or your respiratory therapy colleagues choose BiPAP or CPAP is really neither here nor there. Start low, titrate up slowly, 5-10 centimeters at a time, and then just really monitor that patient. I can't emphasize this enough. Monitor that patient really closely, making sure that their tidal volumes aren't getting excessively high, making sure that their minimum ventilation is appropriate. On the converse side, making sure their tidal volumes aren't dropping to 50 cc's and all you're doing is ventilating their dead space. So you can get some really great information off the NIV machine when you have a nice tight seal on. So don't just stick it and forget it. Once you do start this patient on NIV, pay attention to the tidal volumes that you're getting and titrate appropriately. But I think good arguments can be made for whether you use CPAP or BiPAP in these individuals. With respect to high-flow nasal cannula, I think if someone does have the ability to be put on BiPAP or CPAP, that's probably your better go. We're really using the robust evidence in the COPD literature and translating it over to asthma. And there's a great case series out of Australia, I believe that was in the late 2010s, where they vented close to 200 patients with NIV, and only eight of these patients ended up ever requiring mechanical ventilation. So the evidence for NIV is definitely robust. Those patients received both CPAP and BiPAP. High-flow nasal cannula, if you really can't tolerate BiPAP, an argument could be made to try it. But really here, it's the flow rate of the high-flow nasal cannula that's going to be of benefit to wash out their dead space and not a high FiO2. But really, I think if you're stuck on high-flow nasal cannula because your patient can't tolerate another form of non-invasive ventilation, we're probably heading down an intubation route fairly soon.
Fair enough. All right. I really like that. So dividing patients into two groups, because I also read a little bit about the controversy around, do you use BPAP or CPAP? But dividing them into two groups certainly makes sense. You know, for that slowly fatiguing patient, that BPAP might make more sense. And for just the super fast breather who just can't get any air in at all, then CPAP might make a bit more sense. And then if they can't tolerate either of those, then high flow nasal cannula are certainly a consideration. But as you said, if you're doing high flow nasal cannula and can't do BPAP or CPAP, then you might be heading towards mechanical ventilation. And so yeah, you need to expect that. Dr. Sommer, any comments about non-invasive?
The only thing I would add is we need to understand the goals of care for these patients as well. And so sometimes the goals of care would allow something like high flow nasal cannula and not non-invasive, or non-invasive is not going to be a bridge to invasive ventilation. So just really understanding where the patient is coming from in terms of where they are in their life for goals of care.
Fair enough. All right, we talked a bit about the decision to intubate an asthmatic with Ben McKenzie in episode 187 on the crashing anaphylaxis patient. And some people with crashing anaphylaxis are crashing with asthma as well. But I'd like to get your take on the very tough decision sometimes on when to intubate an asthmatic. First, Dr. Mel, can you remind our listeners why we try to avoid intubating asthma at all costs? And then we'll talk about when you should go ahead and actually intubate.
Absolutely. So it's really important to get back just to understand the pathophysiology of asthma here with the severe bronchoconstriction and the air trapping that these patients are having. A plastic tube down their throat is not going to actually help in that situation. We're probably just only creating more airway resistance and dead space because now the patient has to breathe through a plastic straw versus their oropharynx. So the intubation in and of itself, although someone may look anatomically easy and your job is far from done at that point, we traditionally talk about contraindications to non-invasive ventilation, and one of them being a patient with a depressed level of consciousness. I think this is one of those classic teaching examples where quite the opposite is actually true. I emphasize with colleagues and my learners that these are patients that even if they are hypercapnic and confused and drowsy, if we can use a medication like ketamine, dexmedetomidine to facilitate NIV, that's actually a great situation. Let's give some time for the medications that actually help the underlying pathophysiology of asthma to work to hopefully prevent the intubation, because now ventilating the asthmatic patient is really where all the challenges begin, and these patients have a very high mortality.
That's a great point that one of the contraindications traditionally to non-invasive has been that the patient's getting drowsy and very hypercapnic. And so normally we would just then go to intubation, but it's especially important to be very aggressive with those medications to try and get them out of that hypercapnic drowsy state so that you can use non-invasive and prevent the intubation in the first place. Dr. Sommer, any comments about indications for the plastic tube and how to avoid the plastic tube and why to avoid the plastic tube?
Just circling back to our talk earlier on blood gases, this is a situation where we probably want to allow permissive hypercapnia. And so even though the patient is hypercapnic, we're going to be dealing with it not necessarily with invasive ventilation, but non-invasive ventilation plus all those other things that we're doing to improve ventilatory status rather than just intubating a patient like we would for another scenario.
All right. Let's say we have our patient here. You've tried CPAP, let's say, and the patient is still not doing well. They're tiring. You've thrown at them epinephrine. You've given them subdissociative dose ketamine. You've given them MAG. You've given them all your beta agonists. You've given them steroids, and you feel they now are about to have a respiratory arrest and they need to be intubated. Dr. Mel, could you run through for us step by step how you're going to intubate this crashing asthmatic?
Absolutely. So this is a team sport. This is something that you're going to need multiple experienced providers in the room, great nurses, respiratory therapists as well, just to manage some of the challenges. So things you need to think about upfront is you need to plan for hypotension. We said these patients are going to be hypovolemic from insensible losses and from their increased intrathoracic pressure. So we're going to plan for hypotension in advance, and we're going to give these patients a fluid bolus of at least 30 to 40 mils per kilo, assuming they have, you know, normal cardiac status. We're going to get an appropriate vasopressor. And I think at this point, epinephrine is a great option, as we're going to get its vasoconstrictive effects and its beta agonist activity to get bronchodilation. So we're going to plan for hypotension. With respect to now their oxygenation and ventilation, so this patient is profoundly hypercapnic and acidotic, and likely this patient is hypoxic as well. So their tolerance for an apnea period is going to be extraordinarily short. So this is a patient, again, where we're going to do absolutely everything we can to make sure that we're maximizing our chances at first pass success. These are our patients who are going to be maintained in my shop on non-invasive ventilation during the apneic period, with a kind of backup rate set up on my ventilator so that I can achieve nice gentle ventilations and not hyperventilate this chest. I want to try to avoid BVM if I can. My patient team and equipment positioning needs to be absolutely pristine, so that once this patient is apneic and they're initially started sitting up, when I lay them down, they are immediately in ear to sternal notch, face plane parallel to the ceiling position. And then I'm going to be using video laryngoscopy with a bougie with my most experienced intubator at the head of the bed, so that I can really maximize my chances of first pass success. Because again, this patient's tolerance for apnea is going to be exceedingly short.
Essentially, we need to plan for hypotension with a fluid bolus and epinephrine either running and or having a push dose, and you're going to maximize your chances of first pass success, because that apneic period, you want it to be as short as possible. And during that apneic period, you really want to have very gentle ventilation going. So those are two very important things to keep in mind as you're preparing for your intubation. What about medications, induction agents? Are you using ketamine and sucks, ketamine and rocuronium? Are you using propofol? Are you using etomidate? And then once you do get that tube in, what are we going to be doing post-intubation?
Loaded question, to say the least. So to start off with, in my mind, I think ketamine and rocuronium are going to be your ideal agents for a rapid sequence induction in this patient. Ketamine, I'd be aiming for in between 1 and 2 milligrams per kilogram IV as a bolus dose, followed immediately by 1.5 milligrams per kilogram of rocuronium. The reason I like rocuronium in these cases is largely due to the difficulty with the ventilation that patients are going to have after the fact. So with appropriate sedation and a longer acting paralytic, I can really just completely take over this patient's ventilation on my ventilator so that I can achieve the parameters that are safest. I should have mentioned, in addition to using kind of a best airway practices with a video laryngoscope and a bougie, these are probably instances to use a large endotracheal tube as well. Hopefully this patient doesn't have anaphylaxis at the same time and a tiny airway requiring a 6-0 tube, because now I think you're really in trouble. But if you can get a big tube to decrease the airway resistance that you're introducing with an endotracheal tube, try to use at least a 7.5 or an 8 tube if you're able to, just so that the vent will be a little bit easier, ICU procedures down the road a little bit easier. But do use a rapid sequence approach with ketamine and rocuronium.
All right. Anything to add there, Dr. Sommer, in terms of preparing for your intubation in the crashing asthmatic and then the steps you're going to take to actually intubate the patient?
Just two small points to add. I think that was an excellent summary. I like apneic oxygenation, so I leave the nasal prongs on these patients because, again, they're likely hypoxic. If you can give yourself a little bit more time by adding those nasal prongs on during your hopefully short intubation attempts, that's great. And then I would consider, and there's not lots of evidence behind this, if the patient is quite acidemic and you're going to have a short apneic period, those are maybe some patients that I would push an amp or two of bicarb pre-intubation. Again, that's not evidence-based, but I think maybe it gives you just that couple moments of buffer.
Good point. All right, so just a couple of the nuances there. Considering an amp of bicarb, having nasal cannula running during your whole intubation procedure, using a big tube. The other one is just trying to keep your patient sitting upright the entire time and then intubating them not lying flat. I mean, that's what we'd normally do, is, you know, keep them at a 45 degree angle. These patients do better sitting up, so you want to keep them sitting up for as long as possible peri-intubation. And then some people recommend, you know, doing that sort of forced exhalation before you connect them to the circuit. So that's just another little tip. Can we talk a little bit more about permissive hypercapnia? And this segues nicely into how you want to set your ventilation parameters. Dr. Mel, why do we want permissive hypercapnia, and then how do we achieve that with our vent?
Absolutely. So back to really what we're trying to achieve here, and we want to give these patients a prolonged period of exhalation so that they can decrease their auto PEEP and their gas trapping that they're having. So as a function of that, with having a respiratory rate sometimes as low as 6 or 8, you are going to have patients who you're going to tolerate a bit of a higher CO2 and a lower pH so that these patients can fully expire and you can avoid dynamic hyperinflation. Especially with these young patients, you can tolerate pHs of 7.0, 7.1 without too much difficulty. I don't think this is the podcast to go into the nuances necessarily of bicarb therapy and everything in the intensive care unit, but you know, there definitely is some evidence for bicarb in patients whose pHs are under 7.1. But really, we're okay not having to vent this person to perfect numbers on our EMR. We want a nice long exhalation time, give this patient time to expire, avoid dynamic hyperinflation. And as a side effect of that, yes, you're going to tolerate a slightly higher CO2, but you're going to be continuing intensive bronchodilator and steroid therapy in the background so that you can kind of basically treat this patient's underlying pathophysiology. And the intubation and the endotracheal tube is not going to do that in and of itself.
So Dr. Mel, you nicely outlined the principles of ventilatory settings, but can you just go over the ventilatory settings that we want to hit? Because while some of us are lucky enough to have respiratory therapists do all of this for us, some of us are in smaller communities or in hospitals where we're going to have to take care of that vent and know the vent settings. So could you just sort of review for us the vent settings we should be aiming for? And we'll have these in the show notes for our listeners to review as well.
Yeah, absolutely. This is going to be one of the most complex parts of managing your asthmatic patient, but I'm a simple man. I'm not an intensivist by training. So just in the transport environment, I like to keep things simple as well. With respect to this, we use what's kind of basically referred to as an obstructive ventilation strategy. So in terms of what the buttonology is actually going to look like, your tidal volumes are going to be most important. These patients are all going to be paralyzed, so they'll be on an assist control mode of ventilation. I personally always use volume because mils mean much more to me. In my mind, I can conceptualize them more than centimeters of water, right? So I use an assist control volume strategy so I know exactly what the tidal volumes the patient's receiving. So you're going to set tidal volume to 6 to 8 mils per kilo of ideal body weight for your patient. Next, you're going to set your respiratory rate to 10 as your starting point. And then whether your ventilator uses an I to E button or an inspiratory time button, those both achieve the same effect. You basically want to make sure that your patient is having a much longer time for expiration than inhalation. So somewhere around, let's say a 1 to 4 or 1 to 5 strategy. If you're doing a rest rate of 10 a minute, to really simplify that, so at 10 breaths a minute, you basically have 6 seconds of breath. So an IDE ratio of 1 to 5 would mean the patient's taking 1 second to inspire, 5 seconds to expire. So depending on which ventilator you have, you might have to adjust the flow rate or the IDE button. But either way, you should be able to at least see an IDE value. And then your ventilator is probably going to want to alarm with peak pressure alarms. Just remember that it's your plateau pressure that you're most worried about. That's what's actually causing the lung injury. And if your plateau pressures are reading high, just keep titrating down the tidal volumes to even as low as 4 mils per kilo. We already mentioned that permissive hypercapnia is kind of the background philosophy on these patients. We don't need to ventilate them to normal parameters right away. Let the drugs that you're giving work. So really quickly to summarize that, events, tidal volumes of 6 to 8 mils per kilo, a long IDE ratio of 1 to 4, 1 to 5 with a low resp rate, keeping your SATs about 90%. They shouldn't need much oxygen. And then with regards to PEEP, just keep it low, anywhere between 0 and 5, you'll stay out of trouble.
Okay, let's say you've done all your high fives, you've got your asthma patient intubated, you've sweated quite a bit, you've now got them on the vent, you know what vent settings to get them on, you go see another patient, and then you get called back to the resuscitation room because your patient on the vent is not doing well. We've all heard about the DOPES mnemonic to deal with patients who are crashing on a vent. Could you give us a little bit of insight into how you would manage the patient who's crashing on the vent after you've just sweated through an asthma intubation?
If you haven't done enough hard work up to this point, once this patient is on the ventilator, by no means don't relax that your work is done by any stretch. The ventilatory management of asthma patients is extremely challenging and the complication rates are quite high. I think specifically from a transport point of view, I can recall a number of cases of transporting very sick ICU level asthma patients in Australia. You get them intubated and stabilized, put on appropriate vent settings. And then now all of a sudden, 30 minutes later, you're at altitude, you have your helicopter rotor going, you have your helmet on. It's not an environment that's exactly conducive to great physical exams necessarily or ancillary tests. And then suddenly that patient becomes hypoxic and hypotensive and tachycardic. I think this is an instance in which really muscle memory needs to take over. And whether you are someone who likes mnemonics like DOPES, I personally don't. It usually takes me more time to remember what the bloody mnemonic stands for than just go through things. But anyone who has worked with me clinically knows that I'm a massive proponent due to my training of checklists and using emergency checklists. And this is one classic example. So when your patient isn't doing well on the ventilator, your asthma patient being the classic example, being very deliberate and purposeful with going through DOPES is important. So step number one, you and your partner, you're going to go through this together, cross-check each other. Is my tube dislodged? So you all have access to hopefully a video laryngoscope. Put the VL device in and make sure that your cuff is not herniated and that your cuff is inflated. Next, we're going to go to, is my tube obstructed? So disconnect, I'm able to pass the suction catheter down. And you know, oftentimes with these asthma patients, they form quite a bit of mucus plugs. Make sure that your hopefully large bore endotracheal tube hasn't been plugged up and doesn't need suctioning. Next, pneumothorax. Obviously in the air, we wouldn't have the benefit of auscultation, but a quick clinical exam by feeling for sudden sub-Q emphysema or more importantly, bedside ultrasound to rule out a pneumothorax. Next, equipment dysfunction. So we're going to be making sure we disconnect the ventilator, making sure that our oxygen going from the wall all the way to the patient, making sure our now BVM, which because we've disconnected the vent, our BVM is hooked up to oxygen with an appropriate size mask and our circuit is closed with the PEEP valve, making sure that my endotracheal tube cuff is up, making sure that there's no breaches in the endotracheal tube and going through all my equipment. And then lastly, breath stacking. And this is going to be life-saving. If you work emergency medicine, intensive care long enough, you will save an asthmatic's life by doing this, by disconnecting the ventilator, performing a bilateral thoracic decompression just with a tight squeeze of their thoracic cavity, releasing air and the dynamic hyperinflation, allowing that patient to now have preload again, reconnect your BVM and hopefully your ventilator, and then start over and reassess. So I think these are instances in these acute emergencies. Don't cut corners. Be slow and purposeful with your partner to go through your DOPES in order to make sure that you don't miss anything. But I definitely recall one case of dynamic hyperinflation in flight, which was, you know, thankfully easily treated with a chest decompression. But you need to make sure you don't skip all the other things and just go straight to this.
It's the best DOPES summary I've ever heard. Thank you so much, Dr. Mal. Excellent.
That was so awesome.
There is going to be the occasional patient that even when they're intubated, you can't get the air pressures down and they just can't oxygenate. Who are you getting on the phone when you've intubated your patient and they're still not doing well? Dr. Summer?
Well, obviously, at this point, I'd have my critical care team involved. This is a patient who's going to need critical care. So that would be the first call. I'd consider all those things that Dr. Mal had already mentioned. So make sure that there's no equipment malfunction, go through your DOPES mnemonic. And finally, if really there's nothing else that's working, and we really think that this is mostly spasm of the lower airways, then potentially an anesthetist could be your best friend. Having an inhalational anesthetic can be a profound muscle relaxer. And so putting that patient on the anesthetic unit and getting them induced with an inhalational anesthetic can totally change their respiratory status. So calling anesthesia to talk about that would be a great thing to do in that scenario.
And Dr. Mal, any role for ECMO in these patients if you've exhausted every other possibility in your emergency department?
Well, you're really at the end of the line now in your asthma treatment. I would absolutely get on the phone with intensive care, or cardiothoracic surgery, whoever does manage ECMO at your site. And if this patient is so profoundly hypercapnic and acidotic, there's potentially a role to scrub off CO2. But ultimately, that's going to be a joint decision with multiple specialists involved, as this is really kind of end of the line therapy at this point.
All right. Our 38-year-old patient was given continuous salbutamol, ipratropium, epinephrine, IV methylprednisolone, 6 grams of IV magnesium sulfate, a bit of fentanyl for anxiolysis, started on CPAP, intubated with ketamine and ROCK, hooked up to the vent on appropriate settings to avoid that breast stacking and barotrauma we talked about. She was shipped off to the ICU and discharged home 5 days later on a beta agonist with a steroid inhaler as well as prednisone with a clear action plan, a peak flow meter, and follow up with respirology. Another life saved. So before we sign off, remember that by far the most popular blog series we've ever had on EM Cases. The website is the ECG Cases blog with ECG Master Jesse McLaren. You've also probably heard Dr. McLaren on our EM Quick Hit series. Well, again, if you didn't hear from last episode, I have big news for you. Jesse McLaren now runs online ECG interpretation courses for every level of expertise. The name of the course is HEARTS. This is your best way to up your ECG interpretation skills and pick up some of those life-saving ECG changes. There's an upcoming course designed specifically for EM residents and registrars May 18th to 25th, and an advanced HEART course for practicing EM docs June 23rd to 30th. He even now offers courses for paramedics and medical students too. These are expertly designed, clinically focused, simple, and systematic approaches to ECG interpretation specifically for emergency medicine providers. All the info and easy registration is at heartsecgcourse.com. That's heartsecgcourse.com. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for your insights into the sick asthma patient. And it was an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
The pleasure was all mine. Thanks again so much for having me.
Thank you very much for allowing me to share this platform with you. It's been a great experience.